utmost scrupulousness and sobriety, and that, because of wealth, an exhibition all too lavish is made of the spoils of conquered nations. Reflecting finally that whatever one people has snatched away from all the rest may still more easily be snatched by all away from one. Nay, it were better to support this law by our conduct and to subdue our desires by direct assault, rather than to circumvent them by logic. If we can, let us speak more boldly. If not, let us speak more frankly. Letter 88. On Liberal and Vocational Studies. You have been wishing to know my views with regard to liberal studies. My answer is this. I respect no study, and deem no study good, which results in money-making. Such studies are profit-bringing occupations, useful only in so far as they give the mind a preparation and do not engage it permanently. One should linger upon them only so long as the mind can occupy itself with nothing greater. They are our apprenticeship, not our real work. Hence you see why liberal studies are so called. It is because they are studies worthy of a free-born gentleman. But there is only one really liberal study, that which gives a man his liberty. It is the study of wisdom, and that is lofty, brave, and great-souled. All other studies are puny and puerile. You surely do not believe that there is good in any of the subjects whose teachers are, as you see, men of the most ignoble and base stamp? We ought not to be learning such things. We should have done with learning them. Certain persons have made up their minds that the point at issue with regard to the liberal studies is whether they make men good. But they do not even profess or aim at a knowledge of this particular subject. The scholar busies himself with investigations into language, and if it be his desire to go farther afield, he works on history. Or, if he would extend his range to the farthest limits, on poetry. But which of these paves the way to virtue? Pronouncing syllables, investigating words, memorizing plays, or making rules for the scansion of poetry? What is there in all this that rids one of fear, roots out desire, or bridles the passions? The question is, do such men teach virtue or not? If they do not teach it, then neither do they transmit it. If they do teach it, they are philosophers. Would you like to know how it happens that they have not taken the chair for the purpose of teaching virtue? See how unlike their subjects are, and yet their subjects would resemble each other if they taught the same thing. It may be, perhaps, that they make you believe that Homer was a philosopher, although they disprove this by the very arguments through which they seek to prove it. For sometimes they make of him a Stoic, who approves nothing but virtue, avoids pleasures, and refuses to relinquish honor even at the price of immortality. Sometimes they make him an Epicurean, praising the condition of a state in repose, which passes its days in feasting and song. Sometimes a peripatetic, classifying goodness in three ways. Sometimes an academic, holding that all things are uncertain. It is clear, however, that no one of these doctrines is to be fathered upon Homer, just because they are all there. For they are irreconcilable with one another. We may admit to these men, indeed, that Homer was a philosopher. Yet, surely he became a wise man before he had any knowledge of poetry. So, let us learn the particular things that made Homer wise. It is no more to the point, of course, for me to investigate whether Homer or Hesiod was the older poet, than to know why Hecuba, although younger than Helen, showed her years so lamentably. What, in your opinion, I say, would be the point in trying to determine the respective ages of Achilles and Patroclus? Do you raise the question, through what regions did Ulysses stray? Instead of trying to prevent ourselves from going astray at all times. We have no leisure to hear lectures on the question whether he was sea-tossed between Italy and Sicily or outside our known world. Indeed, so long a wandering could not possibly have taken place within its narrow bounds. We ourselves encounter storms of the spirit, which toss us daily, and our depravity drives us into all the ills which troubled Ulysses. For us, there is never, lacking the beauty to tempt our eyes, or the enemy to assail us. On this side are savage monsters that delight in human blood. On that side, the treacherous allurements of the ear. And yonder is shipwreck, and all the varied category of misfortunes. Show me rather, by the example of Ulysses, how I am to love my country, my wife, my father, and how, even after suffering shipwreck, I am to sail toward these ends, honorable as they are. Why try to discover whether Penelope was a pattern of purity, or whether she had the laugh on her contemporaries, or whether she suspected that the man in her presence was Ulysses before she knew it was he. Teach me, rather, what purity is, and how great a good we have in it, and whether it is situated in the body or in the soul. Now, I will transfer my attention to the musician.